The Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference, co-sponsored by the Institute for Anarchist Studies and Institute for Social Ecology, aims to provide a space in which to re-examine and reinvigorate the social and political tradition of anarchism. Are cooperatives a dual power strategy? The two aspects to a dual power are, on the one hand, creating new structures of a just and democratic society under the noses of existing institutions, and, on the other, directly challenging those existing institutions in order to dismantle and overthrow them. Anarchists are committed to workers' control and are usually proponents of workers' cooperatives as a revolutionary strategy. But is an economy based on worker ownership, or is it based on other forms of cooperatives, really the economy we want? Is the development of cooperatives a revolutionary strategy or a dual power strategy? And if it's not a revolutionary strategy, what would make it so? Stacy Cordero is an organizer and technical assistance provider to worker, consumer, and producer cooperatives at the Cooperative Development Institute, along with its sister organization, Cooperative Life, the Northeast Federation of Cooperatives in Greensfield, Massachusetts. Formerly, she was the cooperative organizer at the Cooperative Economics for Women in Jamaica Plain. She has an MA in City Planning, concentrating in Economic Development Planning from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and is currently a participant in the Jamaica Plain Mutual Aid Network.
And I actually thought about changing the name of this after it went to the printer, but it's too late. Because I actually, this whole question of dual power is something that I've been thinking about a lot. I did a workshop kind of like this one 2 years ago at the last RAT that turned out that demonstrated to me that I hadn't really fully formed my ideas in this area, and that what I ended up coming out of it was like, I'm asking a dual power question. I'm asking, are workers' cooperatives a revolutionary strategy and something that we want to use to build? Are they something that are the seeds of a new economy, and do they challenge the existing economy? And my flippant kind of internal answer back then was, well, no, they're just not. And we need to just, stop. I help people create worker co-ops for a living. And, 5 years ago when I set out to create that job for myself, I was convinced that was, what the new economy was, and that was the basis of it, and that's what I was interested in seeing. Now that I'm actually doing that for a living, I've kind of moved on again. I'm like, now I need something bigger and different, and now I'm dissatisfied with the work that I'm doing. So it's kind of come out of that. So the two aspects of dual power that I kind of wanted to talk about were the question of, is building workers' cooperatives, creating a new system. Is that does that embody the system that we want to see to replace capitalism? And my thinking around that has been basically what a lot of people heard me say yesterday was that I'm no longer interested in an economy built just around workers' cooperatives, because the way that I've seen that play out in reality is that I haven't seen an economy built on workers' cooperatives, but I've been working towards it and helping people create cooperatives. My work is really helping workers become capitalists, and that's a kind of tough thing for me to realize after having done this work for a while. It's basically my job to, a group of people comes to me, they want to start a cooperative. I sit down with them and I start immediately asking them very, very capitalist questions. I ask them, who are their customers? What is their customer base? What is the product that they're trying to sell the customers? Who their competition is? And what is the basis on which they're going to compete with other people for those customers, for those dollars that those customers have? So I immediately teach them capitalist entrepreneurial skills, which is not what I really want to be doing. And a lot of the workers' co-op people really rebel against that. And they say, that's not what we want to be doing. And I actually am in a position to convince them that in order to have a successful workers' cooperative, they have to be thinking this way. And what that kind of did for me was to realize that what I'm doing is making capitalism a little more palatable for people by giving people a little more control over it, possibly even making capitalism work a little bit better, like kind of returning to the original Adam Smith style capitalism of many small producers with good information about with which to make decisions. And it's almost a kind of a better capitalism than I'm trying to create a better capitalism, and I'm dissatisfied with that. That's not what I want to be doing. So it's a very personal thing. This is how my brain operates, is that my thinking comes through my personal experiences a lot. So then, you know, I pretty much rejected that and saying that I don't want an economy based on workers' cooperatives, partially because, for a few reasons, partially because of the way work is defined. If we define work as, you know, tasks that are done in the monetary economy, meaning somebody pays you to do them, you go out and use a skill that you have, and somebody pays you for it. There's a lot of things that we do that are important parts of our lives that don't fall into that category. A lot of stuff that happens outside of the monetary economy that's really valuable stuff. And so the whole idea that we're going to invest all of the decision making about the economy in people who are workers, who work in, you know, who work in factories is what we kind of imagine, but who work in workplaces that exchange their labor for money, is kind of discounting this whole sphere of social work that gets done without money, and it systematically excludes people like women, people like, you know, older people and younger people, who and economically disenfranchised people who often do more of the work that needs to be done in a community outside of the monetary economy. So I'm not interested in concentrating economic decision making power in people who define themselves as workers, you know, unless we were going to redefine that whole thing. And I'm also not interested in bringing every human transaction into the monetary economy. So the only solution that I see is to divorce the decision-making power from that group of people. So I'm still on our cooperatives creating a new structure that we... when I put that out to some people, the answer that came back to me was, well, you know, maybe we don't want an economy based on workers' cooperatives, but workers' cooperatives are teaching people valuable skills of self-management, and that's a kind of basis for, you know, that's part of the dual power strategy of building a new institution, is teaching people self-management, and I do buy that, and I think that's a really valuable thing, but I think that it's not as big as I initially thought it was. So the other half of dual power is challenging the existing institutions. And when I first got into workers' cooperatives and wanting to do work with cooperatives, that's what I was imagining that I was getting into, was like, we're going to reorganize the economy in workers' cooperatives, and we're going to take down capitalism, and it's going to... And I'm really realizing now that that in my work and practice, I'm really, you know, teaching workers' cooperatives how to play the game, how to act like capitalists, how to develop a friendlier capitalism that maybe people won't feel as rebellious against. And I'm really starting to think that this is not a strategy that's not challenging the institution of capitalism. It is kind of wrestling the power over the economy away from the existing capitalists and putting it into the hands of workers. But it doesn't take down the actual framework of capitalism. It just grabs the reins of it and gives it to us instead of a fewer number of rich people. But it still doesn't take away the structure in itself, that of competition and accumulation and the profit motive and the drive to accumulate capital. So, okay. So that's kind of a break. Does anybody have like anything that didn't make sense just now that they want to ask me about? I have more kind of stuff to get into. I'm not going to go on forever, but I have a whole other chunk about that size, and I want to ask if anybody has any questions about that first before I do the other.
What kind of co-ops were you all setting up? Like, you have a wide variety of experience in goods, food, housing. Where's your...
I work for an organization that that does all kinds of cooperatives. There's basically, you can think of it as kind of a chart of the available types of cooperatives, right? And the rows are kind of like, there's three basic structures of cooperatives. One is a workers' cooperative, one is a consumers' cooperative, and one is a producers' cooperative, basically. And then across this way, you'll have like industries that cooperatives can be in. So like housing, groceries, agriculture, manufacturing. So, and you know, typically you'll find like a manufacturing cooperative is not usually consumer-owned, it's typically worker-owned. And an agricultural cooperative is typically producer-owned. Food cooperative is typically consumer-owned, but sometimes it's a hybrid of consumers and workers. So my organization has experience in all of those. We do mostly work with agricultural cooperatives and energy cooperatives, which are consumer-owned. Personally, I have more experience in workers' cooperatives. Before this job, I worked at a place called Cooperative Economics for Women in Boston that was kind of taking like a international development model of starting cooperatives as income-generating projects for low-income women and kind of trying to apply that in inner city, you know, in an inner city in Boston. It's a model that developed in rural India, and we tried to apply it in Boston. That was really problematic. that was a good learning experience too. But that's kind of so the small cooperatives that I was working with, all of our all the people that we worked with at my old organization were immigrants and refugees who lived in Boston, and so we worked with and they were mostly service industries. There was cleaning. They were all workers' co-ops. There was a cleaning co-op, a restaurant co-op, and a garment manufacturer's co-op. And then right now, I'm working with my main areas right now are food cooperatives and manufacturing workers' co-ops.
How many people are in your group?
At the place where I work? Mm-hmm. Like eight altogether, eight or nine. We're a really small organization trying to do way too much. Very stressful.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, in your definition of economics, it seemed to me that you were saying all monetary economy is capitalist and all non-monetary is non-capitalist. Is that right, or is it?
No. Okay. I mean, I would say that all capitalist economy is monetary, maybe. I'm not saying that all monetary economy is capitalist. I mean, I feel like you can definitely have non-capitalist economies that are based on money, for sure. The whole question of money is something that's not really well-formed in my mind. I do like to imagine an economy without money, but I'm not really prepared to talk about that right now because it's kind of vague in my mind, and it's easier for me to talk in terms of money.
I wasn't trying to get at that abstract notion.
Yeah.
I was just trying to... It seemed to me that your critique economically of cooperatives is that they participated in a capitalist economy. You're saying, I'm teaching them to be capitalists.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if that definition for you just meant because they're participating in the market economy. And then you use the other example of non-monetary economy. So.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to kind of get into what I imagine instead of the capitalist economy. I mean, because I've been thinking a lot about that. It's like, well, I don't like the framework that we're in. What do I think about for a different framework? So.
And could I just have one other thing, clarification on dual power? Do you mean just a political conception of it? Is that what you...
As opposed to what?
As both an economic and a social and a political. If you're not clear, that's fine.
Sorry.
I'm not saying I am.
I don't know. That's. I'm not a real theory kind of person. For me, maybe Suresh has something to say about that. I will say one thing that I feel like we left out yesterday that was actually one of the themes running through our presentations that nobody seemed to actually get around to making because we all found it so obvious, was that, anarchists are the only people who are thinking about economics. Well, maybe not. I kind of think that anarchists are the only people who are thinking about economics without the state, or imagining economics without the state. And so in doing so, we really look towards, we're looking at stateless societies as our learning, you know, for our learning experiences, and which means that we turn to, like, anthropology, sociology, we turn to a lot of disciplines that are kind of bigger than economics. And so for me, I don't, you know, maybe the distinction you're making between political and economics is not exactly the same thing, but it, I feel like it has to be broad. But anyway.
Thanks.
Okay. So the thing I'm going to do is broaden it a little bit now. Now that I've turned you all off to workers' cooperatives, right? is talk about the three kinds of cooperatives that I told you about: worker-owned, consumer-owned, producer-owned. And kind of, you know, I actually, through this job that I have now, have actually learned a lot about other kinds of cooperatives, and kind of learned that, you know, coming at it, learning the different angles that people were coming at this, besides just from the worker cooperative angle, each group of people thinks that their type of cooperative is the most revolutionary way of organizing things, which is interesting. I hadn't actually known that. I hadn't met people who thought that producers' cooperatives were really revolutionary. So there's kind of arguments that you can make for each one, and each one has kind of pluses and minuses. And I'll just give you, you know, I'll give you a hint. I'm going to explain it, but then I'm going to tell you what I'm going to say right now, is that what I concluded was that none of these models in itself is something that I want to see the basis of organizing of a new economy, and maybe not even the combination of them all. So, for example, for a workers' cooperative, the kind of, the kind of pluses and minuses of the workers' cooperatives are, I think that the most obvious one is that we're most interested in is that it kind of protects the autonomy and dignity of the worker as someone who's, you know, capable of organizing their own job and capable of managing their own working life and doesn't have to, like, be bossed around, basically. On the downside of the workers' cooperatives, like I said, right now it's still based in the market system. And being based in the market system, I should say that, well, let me describe each kind of cooperative a little bit more, because the difference between a cooperative and capitalist business is that a capitalist business is set up to make a profit for its shareholders, in the case of a corporation anyway. That's the only reason for which it's organized. If goods and services get delivered to people in the meantime, you know, that's fine, but only fine in the sense that it puts more profits in the pockets of the shareholders. Legally, on paper, that's the purpose of a corporation is to give profits to its shareholders. Purpose of a cooperative is different than that. And a cooperative is technically organized as a form of corporation, but it's even recognized by the government as an organization that's set up for a different purpose than delivering profits to its shareholders. A consumer's cooperative is organized for the purpose of delivering goods and services to its members, and the members being the customers, so like a food grocery, a grocery store that sells natural foods or whatever, is set up to deliver natural foods to its members. And if any profits get generated in the meantime, that's an additional benefit. So it kind of turns around the whole thing, where, you know, instead of having the profit motive central and the provision of goods and services secondary, a cooperative is like, we're giving you a product and any profits that happen are secondary. Workers' co-ops are set up for the function of serving the needs of the members being the workers. The purpose of a workers' cooperative is to provide good quality jobs for the workers. It's also not built into the model that the purpose of a workers' cooperative is not to deliver good quality products to a community for a reasonable price. That's not the purpose. The purpose is to develop good jobs for the workers. And there's sometimes a conflict there. The film that was showing last night was something that I saw that film 2 years ago at this same conference. And it was totally, I mean, who who saw the film last night about the it's about
Mardi Gras beads.
Yeah, it's like kind of this dual documentary about interviewing the people who went to New Orleans, who go to New Orleans every year for Mardi Gras, and kind of, you know, the fun that they have throwing around these beads and like showing each other their tits for the beads, and like, it's really this kind of it's just horrible. It makes it look really gross and disgusting, and just, you know, especially when it's coupled with the other side of the documentary, which is going to China and interviewing the women workers in the factory that makes these beads. Not just the regular, like, plastic, you know, colored ones, but, like, ones shaped like little plastic penises and, like, all sorts of crap. And the women there weren't really aware of what the beads were being used for. And the filmmaker kind of brought footage of Mardi Gras to the workers in the factory in China, and they were totally appalled. They had, you know, they were like, what are these people doing? They're like, they're crazy, and why do they like these beads so much? They're junk, you know? And they just, you know, couldn't understand it. And then they tried to take footage from the factory and show it to people at Mardi Gras, and of course, the, you know, they're just drunk college students who, like, don't care, and they don't want to be, you know, bothered with looking at this stuff. So my whole point here is that there's a capitalist motive towards making beads, because people will buy them, you know, because there are people who will buy them, even though they're garbage, and even though they're like, you know, so we're, you know, isn't this great? Some businesses created these jobs in China, and like, these are actually, you know, fairly decent jobs for these women, and, you know, compared to what else is available to them, and like, you know, do we really want to be, when I was in school, at the same program that Gon, I think, just finished. I was in, after my first semester, I realized that what I was being trained in was creating jobs. I was one of those people who's, you know, when the politicians talked about, oh, we created all these jobs, I'm one of those people whose job it is to create jobs, so politicians can say that they created jobs, and then the politician hires me to create the jobs, and if I don't do a good job, I get fired. That's pretty much what they told us our job was, and I was like, this sucks. I don't wanna create jobs. I wanna abolish jobs. I don't wanna like work in a framework where we're creating factories for people to make beads just because they need money to survive in a capitalist economy. We're doing them a favor by putting the bead factory there and consuming the beads. Oh, we're doing a great thing for them by buying the beads and throwing them around. Then they wouldn't have jobs. It's just, you know, it doesn't make any sense. So my kind of point is that workers' cooperatives doesn't take away this problem. I mean, the workers themselves are trying to create jobs for themselves. And if that means, you know, if there's a market for dumbass penis beads, then there's going to be someone who's going to take advantage of that. Yeah, we'll work in the bead factory and keep the profits for ourselves and make money off of these dumb kids. So anyway, I guess I'm getting a little into the rant
we're
there,
never
but
forget this example.
Great. So that's the kind of pluses and minuses of the workers' cooperative. And quickly, I mean, for the consumers' cooperative, in a way, this whole issue of consumers' cooperative kind of takes away this like this junk and trinkets problem, where you're not just creating a product just because you think people will buy it and you can make money from it. The purpose of a consumer's cooperative is to provide products that people say that they want, especially products that they say that they want that they can't really get other places. So it kind of takes away that really appalling junk and trinkets problem. It's like the whole purpose of the cooperative is set up to fulfill a real community need that's been identified by the group of people who are members in the cooperative. So that, to me, is a much better model. But then the consumers' cooperative, of course, has a lot of other problems where, you know, it's kind of rightly criticized as being a very yuppie thing. It's like, it's often consumers with more power in the capitalist market, people who have a lot of money, who are able to set up consumers' cooperatives. It's much more difficult for people without money to set up a consumers' cooperative. So there's a little bit of pros and cons there. And then producers' cooperative, I think this is the one that I actually didn't have hardly any experience with at all until I started this new job. And I imagine other people don't know about it. But this is actually one of the biggest forms of cooperatives that exist in this country, and probably the reason why we even have cooperatives at all is that these are mostly agricultural cooperatives, which are really, really popular among just mainstream kind of Midwestern farmer guys. It's really weird how workers' cooperatives are this like very pinko, very marginal kind of thing, but agricultural cooperatives are very mainstream and get a lot of support from the government. My organization gets huge, you know, relatively, I think, huge grants from the government to help us develop agricultural cooperatives. The government doesn't support anybody creating workers' cooperatives. That's, you know, that's really crazy to even think that they would. But, so agricultural cooperatives are kind of a whole different kind of thing. They're mostly, what they mostly are is small farmers who can't get, you know, who grow soybeans or whatever their product is and need to sell it to some kind of processor or distributor or something. The problem is the distributors pay lower. The lower your quantity is that you're selling to them, the lower the price they give you per pound or per ton or whatever it is you're selling it on. The bigger you are, the more you can negotiate what your price is going to be, because the distributors need large quantities in order to fulfill, you know, their suppliers, to fulfill the need of their suppliers. So they want. So what the small producers have done is form cooperatives mostly to pool their products, so they can keep their small farms, but they can pool their product with other small farmers in order to get a better price. So the purpose of agricultural cooperatives, producers' cooperatives generally, is to get a better price for an agricultural product. So that's the motivation behind it. And that is, you know, in a way it's kind of, in a way it's also kind of interesting. It's when I've heard farmers talk, farmers are not at all market-driven. And a lot of our work with agricultural cooperatives is, again, to try and get farmers to think for the market, is to try and convince them that they should care about what people want to buy. From the farmer's point of view, they're like, well, I need to do what's good for this land. I can't grow soybeans on this land this year. It's not going to work. I need to grow something else. And from their point of view, they're looking for a way to learn to sell the thing that they can grow most easily and most cost-effectively. And it's totally the opposite of the way that they're supposed to be thinking, if you accept the market thing. So just this whole idea that the producers' cooperatives, it's like this tension between these totally mainstream farmers, you know, who drive around with, like, American flags on their trucks, I think are doing this kind of amazing thing that they have this tension between, like, they're trying to protect the land. They're trying to protect the land because it's bound up with their livelihood, you know, and themselves and their families and their family tradition. But at the same time, they're trying to protect their land from capitalism a lot, because capitalism is telling them they should grow this product that's going to destroy their land. And they don't want to. They want to grow this other product that's going to be good for the land, but they can't sell it. So those are kind of the tensions in producers' cooperatives. All of these models have people who say, this is the model we should go with. You know, all our economy should be based on this. And they all kind of... they all have... Well, I'll just say they all have this problem of accountability, which is kind of my last point, I guess. My last and biggest point is that ultimately a business organized as a cooperative is going to be accountable back to its members, whether they're workers, consumers, or producers. And the question is, you know, who do we want our economy to be accountable back to? You know, is it good enough that it's, you know, should they be accountable back to the farmers? There's a good argument that it should be accountable back to the farmers. It's important that we conserve the land and keep it healthy. You know, should it be accountable back to the workers? Well, yeah, that's important too. It does need to be accountable back to workers. Does it need to be accountable back to consumers? Well, yeah, we want it to be, you know, set up for the provision of human needs and wants. And so... to me, this question just became then, I'm dissatisfied with really, an economy based on any of those one things, and really on any business based on any of those one things, because there's stakeholders outside of those groups in every business. And so that's when I started thinking about this whole, like, you know, community control of the economy, that a community includes, you know, a community could include all of those people, the consumers, the workers, the producers, as well as people outside of any of those groups that still have an interest in some in that business existing. And the example that I gave last night and that I give a lot is on childcare. You know, how would you organize a childcare cooperative? There's actually really popular to organize childcare cooperatives. Some of them are worker-owned. Some of them are consumer-owned. There's not really a role for producers in childcare co-ops, but... I mean, except indirectly, and but workers, there are workers and consumers, childcare co-ops, lots of them, and the kind of question is, what's the most just model for the provision of childcare? Should it be controlled by the workers who, you know, do all the work, or should it be owned by the consumers, being the parents, who pay for the childcare? And to me, it's like, well, those aren't the only stakeholders involved. There's a community interest in having childcare available to the community. And I, even if I'm not, you know, I don't work in the childcare center, and even if I don't have children, if I'm a part of this community, it's in my interest, and it's part of my responsibility to make sure that there's childcare available in the community for people who do have children. And so, God, I'm ending almost exactly the same place I did last night, which is in this big question that tells you that this is unworkable until we solve this question. But so that's where I kind of got to with, you know, community control, that I'm interested in an economy that's accountable back to people. One thing that I should say is I feel like in my mind, I've totally divorced the two areas of management and governance. And so when I'm talking about ultimate responsibility of, you know, where investment decisions get made, which is a lot of what I talked about last night, that's different from the question of how do you organize your work internally. You know, I believe in worker self-management, and I feel like we don't have a lot of disagreement on that. I feel like we have kind of a general consensus that workers are able to manage themselves and probably do better at it than in a hierarchical management structure. I'm not actually debating that. There's some people who say, like, oh, if there's a community control of the economy, that means that some kind of, you know, community gathering is going to be nitpicking about, like, you know, how to manage the production schedule of each business, and that's not actually what I'm talking about at all. I feel like the model where, in most businesses, including nonprofit businesses, you have a model where you have a board which handles the governance and investment decisions in a business, and it sets the goals and it sets the policies about how you're supposed to reach those goals. The job of management is to fulfill those goals in any way that they can, in that any way that they decide is the way that they want to do it. And so I've taken those two things apart, and mostly what I've been talking about is governance stuff, not so much management stuff, because I think that we have more of a consensus on management. That makes sense? So yeah, where I was ending was accountable back to the community. What community? Who's the community? Which community? Is it just a geographic area? You know, is it a cultural group? Is it an age group? Is it a, you know, what can be your community? And I think that what we're really getting to is that we just live in a world where a geographic area is going to contain multiple overlapping communities. And I think that the trick to this is to not think of a community as a monolith, and there's a community here, and then the border of this community ends, and then there's another community over here that's different. But that, you know, that these things overlap, and that there is a community of people who live in a geographic area, and their common interest is that geographic area. There's, you know, ethnic communities who have, you know, a cultural link that that establishes, like, a common interest. There's, you know, people form communities, you know, on all sorts of things. People form communities over the internet, I guess. You know, it's kind of an open question, what's a community and what's not. Anyway, I just feel like imagining that we can solve that problem, which I feel like is the next big intellectual project. That's cool. So this went on. Shit, I talked way longer than I meant to. Sorry. So we have 25 minutes until 12 o'clock, which is when we're supposed to end. So. And I liked what they did on this earlier thing, which is like get a bunch of comments and then we'll all kind of respond to each one maybe. So, anybody have comments or questions?
I'm just wondering, in all this, do these constraints for each of the different cooperative models and just the reservations you have with propping that up as a dual power structure or something that challenges the bigger system, do those problems break down with scale? Like in each one, you're dealing with each one as an autonomous unit, but when they start working together with these cooperative models and across the different cooperative models, does that then start to theoretically represent a challenge to the structure? I mean, then you're starting to actually develop an economics that works, potentially can start to work towards.
I just have a question about whether you know of any cooperatives that have essentially been hybrids of a couple of the different models, and I imagine that could solve some of the problems and be an interesting model. I really like where you went with all of this, and I imagine sort of where you're going is not just sort of pulling together all the sum of the parts, but actually we have to sort of evolve our thinking into something bigger. But I'm wondering whether you or anybody else here has sort of had glimpses of real community-controlled economic systems and cooperatives, which in many ways does what a lot of people were talking about last night in terms of taking the economics out of being sort of this monolith on its own and sort of really re-embedding it in the community.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, so I guess if there's models of cooperatives, sort of smaller scale hybrid examples, and then larger community-based economies that are really interested.
I guess with producer cooperatives, which I feel like I grew up in a family that works on cranberry hogs, which is totally dominated by ocean spray. So I have like some experience with that, but
which is a cooperative.
What's that?
Which
right,
is
a cooperative. But I wonder what sort of economic power some of the groups you work with have, because I feel like in where I grew up was, you know, one season, you know, ocean spray would set the market, and everyone was sort of dictated by their set market. You know, in some years, like, whole areas would just not produce because they had to keep a market at a certain way, jobs were lost, whatever. And I wonder if there's a way to build economic power with producer cooperatives. I guess the other thing, going back to the original question of dual power strategy, like, I don't think cooperatives themselves in a market economy is a dual power strategy. I think maybe it's, like, kind of a laboratory to experiment with workers' control. But if you look in areas where the market economy's gone into crisis, maybe like Argentina with like the textile factories and the self-occupied or the self-managed occupied factories, you actually see community input and like it can actually build a sort of dual power experiment. So it'd be nice to talk about that as well, like beyond the market economy examples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's do one more on that.
And kind of going off that as well, so I was thinking I would use Argentina as an example, because I spent a lot of last year in Argentina interviewing people and all the different autonomous movements. And I think the experience of workers in Argentina is really an amazing one. It's hundreds of factories that have been taken over and workers are running them collectively. And it's a wonderful experience in direct democracy inside those workplaces. And sometimes with relationship to the community. But in some of those smaller factories, depending what they produce, there's a huge contradiction, because if they're producing sugar or they're metal workers, they're actually having to compete. So it's actually, I think it's more along the lines of what you were saying, is that it's part of a larger movement, and so in that way that experience is amazing. But as far as a question of another power that's actually challenging the same kind of structure of the state, I'm not sure that it's a new power structure or a challenging power structure in what they do, but in their social relationships, I think it is. In the unemployed workers movements in Argentina, I think it's different, and this is more the idea of community. And I think there's a lot we can learn from it. It hasn't happened in big urban areas at all, but people who are occupying land and on that land, whether it's hundreds to sometimes thousands of people, both producing and so using a lot of what they produce, the agriculturally, kind of eating and feeding themselves and making all these decisions collectively, also having small kind of micro-enterprise. And the relationship with that is actually more on an exchange with other people in other communities and other people in the neighborhood. So it's not so much selling as they have a whole barter network. And then they also have cooperative childcare, and some of the different movements have been now putting together kind of new education, new forms of schools and education, looking to the community and the parents to do the schooling. So I think that's a really exciting, and there are a number of exciting possibilities I think that we can learn from. And those experiences, that they're all, you know, learning from problems as well, it's a pretty new thing. But that idea of seeing yourself as part of a community, and they're defining that geographically. Whether, you know, what is a community? Yeah, I guess it's up to people who are defining it, but that's, I think, something we can learn from.
Mm-hmm. Let me just, I feel like this is a good place to take the discussion, but I kind of don't want to lose the two comments up here, too. Do you want to, I think I might just answer your two questions, and I think we should go back to what you're saying here, if that works for people. What you're talking about, it sounds like what you're talking about is there's a set of an international standard of principles that are supposed to be what define cooperatives internationally. It was put out by the International Cooperative Alliance, and they revise it from time to time and add new values. And one of the things that is in there is cooperation among cooperatives, and they've kind of just said, and a lot of people in Canada, actually, especially, people are really, well, this one guy, this guy, Sid Probohushki, or is that, you know, anybody know that guy or how to say his name? He's really an amazing guy, and he's basically saying that he wants to create a cooperative economy basically by cooperatives voluntarily choosing to do business only with other cooperatives. Which is a kind of interesting thing, because it doesn't quite... I think that the issue of competition hasn't come up so much in cooperatives, because usually there's not enough cooperatives to be competing against each other in an industry. Usually the cooperatives are competing against capitalist businesses. So it's kind of unclear what it means to cooperate among cooperatives. Sometimes it means, doing shared purchasing. You know, if there's a lot of small businesses all in the same industry who might, you know, pool their resources in order to get a better price from their suppliers for, you know, office equipment or whatever it is. So there's this kind of principle out there, but it's really unclear how we're supposed to apply it. And then Brooke, with the with hybrids, I actually definitely should have gone into that, because there's these three models, like I said, the producer, worker, consumer, but there are hybrids out there. And I'll give you two examples. One is I think the Weaver Street Market in North Carolina, which is a grocery store that's owned, I don't know about half, but it's owned part by their workers and part by their customers. So, and the way that works is that, in a workers cooperative, you have to buy into the cooperative. You have to buy a membership share. Usually, you know, you try to set the price so it's not prohibitive against people being able to work there because of the price. And usually you can buy in gradually, but you are an owner of the business and you are a shareholder. So the way it works at Weaver Street is that, the consumers put in their membership share, the workers put in their membership share, and then each interested group elects people to the board. And the board is made up of, you know, part workers, part consumers, and probably people from outside the business as well. That is a really interesting thing to me, because it takes this kind of, I mean, those people have competing interests to a degree. The workers are going to want higher wages, the customers are going to want lower prices, and that's, you know, a negotiation that happens. And so I think that's an interesting question, is like, where is that negotiation supposed to happen? A hybrid model says it happens within a business, which is really that's an important thing. Michael Albert wants to have that be a very kind of governed system that exists outside of businesses, but kind of not quite embedded in a community either, I think. Another kind of hybrid model that I'm actually working on right now, it's only theoretical right now, but there's a spinnery that I'm working with that spins wool into yarn. And it's an existing business that's owned by just owners, like capitalists, basically, although they would not describe themselves that way, but that's what they are. And they are retiring and want to sell the business to their employees. And so, and it's looking like they provide two services. They spin yarn and then they sell the yarn. But their other service is that they provide custom spinning services to small wool producers, wool farmers. So because the farmers don't have access to cheap spinning facilities. You know, they have these sheep, they shear the sheep, they got these fleeces, and they want to turn them into yarn to sell, but they need to get them spun. And so the services for spinning yarn are too expensive, they're too far away, they're just inadequate in a lot of ways. So there are spinneries that have been set up as producer-owned spinneries. So they're owned by the farmers because they're set up for the purpose of serving a need that's from the farmers. So for this spinnery, we're thinking about a hybrid model of it being owned partially by the workers and partially by the producers. So that's another example. And then I should also give example of what I'm talking about for community ownership. There are, you know, there's not a really great example that I know about of, like, real utopian community ownership structures. But there's some that kind of get at it. There's an example that I gave a couple years ago when I did a similar workshop was a small town in Indiana that had maybe 1,000 people who lived there, and their one grocery store was closing. And they wanted to keep their grocery store. The next closest one was like an hour's drive away. But no capitalist businesses wanted to come in and operate a grocery store there because it wasn't going to be profitable. So there's that motive thing again. They're driven by profits, and if people get products in the meantime, that's cool. But if there's no profits, then there's no products. So they were saying, well, we don't care about your profits. We want groceries. And so what they did was they formed basically, you know, it wasn't exactly a cooperative, but they formed a corporation in which all of the people in the town were shareholders. They went around door knocking and asked people to become shareholders in this corporation, and most people did. And they put in shares of, and, you know, I think, I forget what it was, but something like 200 or 300 families put in $500, and that's equity that they were then able to borrow against from the bank, and they started their own community-owned grocery store. People are also doing this for department stores in Minnesota, and actually in Western Mass we're working with one that's like, people are starting community-owned, like, Ames-style department store, like, buy cheap clothes kind of place. And so those are just kind of examples. Also the Green Bay Packers. And this gets at the whole thing between, like, needs and desires, you know? It's like, all right, the Green Bay Packers is probably one of the best examples of, it's not a cooperative, but it's a community-owned business. I'm actually not sure exactly who owns it. If you have to be a shareholder in the Packers, if you have to be, I think that you have to be a season ticket holder, but do you have to be, a resident of the state, of Green Bay. So, I mean, so there you go. It's like, it's clearly not a need, but I mean, it really is for some people. Like, some people really, really want the Green Bay Packers, and they're willing to pay for it. And, you know, okay, this is great, but it's actually one of the best examples out there of a community-owned business.
Where did you say the department stores were? Western Mass and...
There's one in, did I say Minnesota? I think I meant Montana. I'm not sure exactly, but I know the woman who started it, and it's a very difficult project for them because it's in a very rural area that has a, you know, really low population, is just not served by any business. It's not profitable for any business to go in there and sell these people blue jeans. They're gonna, you know, they're basically gonna sell people blue jeans and a couple of other blue jeans and t-shirts. Like, that's pretty much what they're gonna concentrate in. And it's just very basic, like, what people really want and need.
I was just wondering what you think about the general setup of cooperatives, like with like a board of directors and stuff. Like, does that work, or would there be more participatory ways to run co-ops, or mm-hmm. does that kind of train of thought?
Yeah. I'm wondering if I should do the same thing. I don't know if that really do the same thing again. Okay.
Yeah, I think that almost inevitably when we discuss cooperatives and fitting into a context of organizing a new society, there's always a couple of tensions that inevitably arise. And I think I can raise two. There's definitely way more. And I think that two of them are, one, the amount, to the degree that cooperatives are integrated into the capitalist economy and co-opted and cooperative with capital in the state. And I think a lot of the more legalized cooperatives that we're familiar with in North America fit broadly into that. And I think there's the other one, the other tension on the flip side of that, are cooperatives that are set up by people that are in active confrontation with capital of the state. And I think definitely the examples raised in Argentina fit into that side more broadly. I use an example that I was involved in Toronto. Everyone's, I think, is probably familiar with the basic housing cooperative. I'm not really that familiar with that, to be honest, so I'm not going to try to get into that. But one thing that we did in Toronto is a community group that I'm involved in, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. We organized in my neighborhood quite publicly with lots of advanced preparation and said that we were going to occupy a building. And not only that, I think one of the things that was interesting about when we did this is that, like, pretty much for the first time, we said we were going to occupy this building to put political pressure on the state to build more housing, you know, to get, you know, more funds for housing. But we were explicit and, like, we're like, we want to open housing and self-manage it by the people who are living there and, you know, part of our community group and part of our movement. And, you know, there was definitely ups and downs and struggles with that. But I think what separated that experience, and we occupied the building and we held it for just over 3 months before the police finally evicted us on orders from the city, because, let's face it, militarily we weren't prepared to defeat the Toronto Police Force. I think that, like with that example, like that was a really inspiring experience in Toronto, much more so than like all the people that were involved in housing co-ops that are, you know, go through the legal system and the whatever the proper cooperative form. I think the reason that it was so inspiring and exciting to be a part of it and like went far beyond just like opening up another co-op is because it directly challenged the concept of private property. It directly challenged the right of the police to do evictions. It directly challenged, you know, the right of landlords to own buildings and let them fall into disrepair. And I think broadly that if we're going to build a cooperative movement or a worker control movement, that it has to be confrontation. It has to be confrontation with the state, with capital, and like not just like opening occupied buildings and like self-managed buildings, but like workplaces especially. Like maybe to touch briefly on a workplace in a North American context, like we can talk about Argentina. Argentina is a really amazing example, but on a lesser scale, this winter there's a small town in Quebec called Le Joliet, and they have an aluminum works factory that was shutting down like half the plant. They were shutting the smelters down, and in protest of this, the workers at the Joliet aluminum works took control. Well, they didn't take control. They didn't occupy the factory, but they organized like a really strong like movement, like community based movement. Like pretty much the entire town of Joliet was behind it and came like mass demonstrations, like with you know, something like, you know, half the population of the town was there. The workers ran the factory under workers' control for just over a month. And I think eventually they negotiated some kind of compromise with the company and like kept like the smelters open, or they're trying to work out some deal with the government to open like an auto manufacturing plant, like if this one closes, so they keep the jobs in Joliet and it doesn't become kind of a depressed wasteland economy like a lot of small towns are becoming right now. But I think that was important. Like because once again, because of the degree of confrontation, which was I think quite less than is in Argentina right now, but like they weren't trying to form a legalized cooperative through the proper channels and then like buy the building and set up a little bit. Basically, they were saying we're the workers here, we work here, we can run this business without management, and like I think that was shown quite efficiently that they did that. They produced something like, within a week they produced like $3 million of aluminum goods from the existing stock that they had, which is like a much, much higher efficiency ratio than when they were actually listening to their managers and four persons who were there. And I think, basically I think what it breaks down to is like, when we build cooperatives and are we following like a gradualist anarchist approach? Or maybe not even anarchists, because certainly the workers in the Joliet aluminum works were not anarchists; they were workers. But is it a gradualist approach where like we build all these small cooperatives or even larger cooperatives like through the legal structure and like which are cooperative, like not non-confrontational with the state, or and will that gradually as we build more and more of these move to an anarchist or libertarian communist society? Or is it a revolutionary perspective that we need to have where these can be parts of these can be, like Mike Mark said, like laboratories of self-management and experience building, but do we eventually need a revolution? Do we need to, overthrow the state, smash it up, like reorganize the productions, like defeat the military, defeat the state? And like that is certainly the position that I have. I think that we need a revolutionary movement. We can't have a gradualist movement. It needs to be quite confrontational and, hopefully not violent. Like the bigger the movement is, the less violence that will be necessary. But definitely need a very confrontational movement in the cooperatives.
Okay. Some people itching to respond. Here, and there.
I'm very sorry, I walked in, but I just wanted to respond to the question. Okay. I don't want to make more than anything on it because I walked in late. I would just want to say perhaps there's a third option between just saying gradualism versus revolutionary practice and say that perhaps it is possible to set up long-term structures that give people experiences that will promote more long-term revolutionary activity, because the examples you gave are really good. And the stuff in Argentina is fantastic, but the stuff in Argentina was precipitated by major, major collapses in the system, which I don't necessarily want us to have to wait for to do work, and something you said a little bit too. But as you said, after a month, the state intervened. After 3 months, the state intervenes. And it also, and it seems just as valuable to have examples of very, very, very long-term, structurally sound things that can subsist. Obviously, with a huge degree of tension in a capitalist society, but can still subsist for a very long time if only to try to encourage other people to experiment in that way whenever their lives are on the line. I mean, it's not just it's good to have revolutionary laboratories and stuff, but when we're talking about people's jobs and people's homes, it's where they live and how they stay alive, and it takes a lot for people to. And you can, if there's a state of crisis, like if the factory's going to shut down, their town's going to go, everyone in their town's going to lose their job, sure, they'll work, they'll do stuff like this. But it would be nice if we could also say to people, this isn't just something that you have to do as a last resort, but people that aren't already, militant and politicized. This is why this, here's some examples of how this works long-term, it makes a lot of sense, and is very different than how is really structurally different in the way you have to organize than things are organized now in both your workplaces and your living environment. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to think of it as you taking on every organized power in the world. This is something that's very feasible. So, it just seems like we can't. I don't necessarily want to wait for moments of crisis and to try to use or moments of crisis in either in local situations or in national or global situations to be able to do constructive work that really gets a lot of people involved and interested. I'm not saying that we have to do it in moments like that, in political moments like that. I'm just saying I don't think there's necessarily an opposition, and that you can do a variety of tracks that all follow and promote the same tendencies. Which, in the long term, it's those tendencies we're trying to promote. We're trying to promote tendencies of self-management and create possibilities for, you know, cooperative, like really radical cooperative organization. And I think it can be worrisome to worry too much about the particularities of the mechanisms we're doing for that, as long as we keep in mind some loyalty to the tendencies, so that we don't say, you know, build cooperatives and then turn them into very standard, you know, capitalist forming structures. I mean, as long as organizationally and institutionally things can keep that sort of thing in mind somehow, that might mean, you know, I think there's some advantage. Cooperative people getting into a cooperative organization have benefited tremendously from the fact that Montegrun in Spain, for instance, or the Italian cooperative sector in Italy, have existed for as long as they have, even if, and according to many or some, or I'm not horribly like entrenched in this literature, but they're becoming more cooperatives and more international corporations. That's true, but for a long time, they existed in a fairly decent form. They provide very strong examples that get people interested, and that people can use to push it in other sectors, which seems good.
We're getting right past our time now. There's still people who want to make comments, so the people who are left, like, can you just be quick?
Okay, so I want to first draw a story and then take two points that came up sequentially. One is, so Red Vienna in the 1920s had like 500,000 union members out of a city of 2 million, and the trade unions ran all these co-ops that did practically everything. And then when the fascists tried to take power in like the late 20s or something, the trade union declared like this sort of generalized strike. And what's important about that is that the trade union instituted its own sort of planning and price mechanisms to sort of manage to get all the cooperatives and things to produce things efficiently for everybody because they had shut everything else down. And so they managed to run this sort of alternative economy for some time. But based on this sort of very, you know, these formal co-ops and stuff, and sort of had this brief... So the reason they lost is this stupid story that the union leader handed over the keys to the armory to the fascists. But for a good couple of weeks, they were running this pretty well-done alternative economy using the trade union council as a way of requisitioning goods and then having it organized and produced by the cooperatives. So there's two things about that. One is that sort of idea that that's sort of something what dual power out of cooperatives might look like. The second is that a lot of the problems that come up with cooperatives is that you don't know what to maximize. I think like an economist. It's that when your price is set by the market, you're looking for a much different set of things than when your price is set by a planning board or when your quantity is requisitioned by the trade union council. And so the thing I think that sort of separates the co-ops operating under capitalism from the co-ops operating under some other system is sort of what sets the price that will dictate how much you ought to produce and what should you produce. So it's kind of like, oh, markets will give you a certain price, but other mechanisms might give you a different price, but that the co-ops themselves can work under either of those environments.
Eric, in the book?
I had a question, actually. Mm-hmm. Go with that. Okay, I'm just wondering, do you notice any, or do you observe any differences in how they operate between co-ops that produce goods that are for, you know, let's say blue jeans for everybody, you know, it's basic goods, and ones that produce goods that have a more specialized market, or let's say they're sold to more expensive goods that are sold to maybe more affluent people, do they tend to operate and have different attitudes?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the example that jumps to my mind in contrast to the blue jean one is there's a worker-owned high-tech company that makes I can't even really describe what they make. They're about this big, and they're very pretty. Like, these black discs with, like, kind of shiny colored things in the middle that are different colors on either side, and they shimmer when you... And I think that they're like, you put them on microscopes or something, or... I don't know. But,
Very specialized.
There's very specialized, and there's a ton of money in this. And they're a workers' cooperative. This is not a cooperative that was started by low-income people. I wish that we had made more time for, like, what it's like starting cooperatives with low-income people. Because generally, the lower-income people don't have money to put in to capitalize the cooperative and don't have the free time around to sit around and kind of making plans for the cooperative. So that's really problematic. The guys who started this business started it as a cooperative because they want... This is the only cooperative that I know of that the people who started it were really out to get rich. And that's kind of a crazy thing to think that you get rich off a cooperative, but they're doing pretty well at it. the buy-in to this cooperative was something like $10,000 that had to be paid in within the first, I think, couple years, and their shares in the business have now they've taken their profits that they've made every year, which have been a lot, and put them back into their own membership shares. And so they're now pretty substantial shareholders in this corporation, which conceivably could be sold. And I think that that's probably what they have in mind down the line.
So they're run more like a corporation, but for whatever reason, it makes sense for them to organize it as a co-op.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not really that much difference in the world.
Well, yeah, and that's exactly what I'm saying. Like, there's nothing inherent in the workers' cooperative model that means that you won't be in the business of ripping people off and getting rich yourself. I mean, that's not the way it usually happens, partially because people who start worker cooperatives are not in that mindset. But this is an example of people who were in that mindset who used the cooperative model to do that.
Or use the legal form of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to comment on, I mean, I think that we're all in sort of agreement that we're not going to sort of create a revolutionary society by just having lots of cooperatives. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the problem with the cooperative movement is that oftentimes, for practical reasons often, I think people get stuck in their cooperative and then start operating, or maybe went into it operating as though the cooperative was the end unto itself. And while I think the cooperatives are really useful as laboratories, as Mark was saying, in terms of teaching people how to engage cooperatively and also in terms of drawing resources away from the capitalist enterprises, what I am not sure is happening is really using the cooperatives as places for educating people and for expanding people's minds in terms of thinking about how to really transform society to a larger scale, whether that means, you know, actually using that cooperative and starting to broaden it out and starting to say, okay, we've got a food cooperative, how can we start, you know, thinking more on a larger scale, not just about the consumers, but about the community as a whole and about other resources and really about creating a form of self-governance. And I don't know whether, I mean, I don't know whether that's happened in Guelph or whether that's happened elsewhere, where these cooperatives have really started creating a revolutionary notion in the communities that they're sitting in, and whether there are examples of cooperatives where that's really the goal of the cooperative, is creating a laboratory to start educating people about future possibilities.
Greg?
Oh, Ed, it's just a really small question. I'll try and keep it short. But in the literature on cooperatives, one of the things that I come across, and you sort of brought it up, is that sometimes the failure of cooperatives, in a sense, is that they're too successful. So the shares will increase really rapidly, and it will basically last one generation, and then those shares will be sold, and the people will retire with, you know, a lot of money. And so I have got some really close comrades in Calgary who are trying to start up a co-op, and one of the things that we've discussed at length is a strategy of maybe oriented more towards collectives than co-ops. So it's an entity onto itself. You don't own a share. You work there. But nobody owns that business. When you leave that business. Just like when you go work for a capitalist, and of course none of us wants to do that, You go work. I mean, you participate in it while you're there. When you leave, you just leave, you know?
Yeah.
Except, you know, without a capitalist.
Yeah. And that's getting at this difference I've been trying to make between management and ownership, which I've made a different name for it, but ownership, governance, investment decision. I mean, you're talking about a self-managed workplace that's, you know, that's the same as, like, the Lucy Parsons Center in Boston. It's, like, it's a nonprofit organization. Nobody owns it. There's no shareholders in it. But it's a worker, a volunteer worker-managed business. It's also the same thing at the nonprofit. It's not at all the same thing, but it's what we're kind of going for at the place that I work at. It's nonprofit. Nobody owns it. So separating this out, you know, I'm not saying that we should all form nonprofits, you know, collectively manage nonprofits, but I do think we should take away this idea of management, you know, and divorce it from the idea of ownership. And in a sense, a nonprofit is kind of, you know, it's kind of community owned because it's like it can't be used for the gain of one particular person. So in that sense,